Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our March Artist of the Month is Jason Narduzzi, a native of Evanston, Illinois, whose career in rock music began in the early 1980s, when he was only 10 years old. His first band, Verboten, only played a handful of shows, although one of them was attended by Dave Grohl, who credited them in his Sonic Highways documentary with introducing him to the punk rock scene. In the 90s, Jason teamed up with cellist Allison Chesley and formed Verbo, who recorded two fine albums for Epic Records, including one produced by Bob Mould, who in 2005 asked Jason to join his band. Since then, he's become a go-to indie rock bassist, touring with such luminaries as Robert Pollard and Superchunk. He now fronts a band called Split Single, whose two albums to date are highly recommended, as are the band's very funny music videos, which showcase Jason's wry sense of humor and his very sexy elbows. I sat down with Jason in a rehearsal room at Mystery Street Recording Company, a studio in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood at which I work, and we'll be hearing our conversation over the next hour. But first, we'll hear the title track from the debut split single album, 2014's Fragmented World.
My mom sings and plays piano, and as a child, I had seen her perform. Mm. She actually performed with my stepdad's band in the 70s. He was a co-founder of a bluegrass band called Special Consensus.
Oh, okay.
Which actually still exists.
Yeah, we had Robbie Foulkes on the show,
yeah.
And he had a tenure.
That's right. Robbie was a guitarist, as was my stepdad in Special Consensus, which
oh,
was a way that when Robbie and I first met, I think we sort of bonded on that, you know, strange connection in our history. But yeah, so I have memories of in the 70s seeing my mom, and obviously my stepdad was in the band, but she would get up there and sing with them at what's now Fitzgerald's. It was a different name at the time in Berwyn, but I remember the room. So yeah, I had my mom was musical, and my dad loved rock music and, you know, saw the Beatles a couple times and was always playing rock music at the apartment. And my mom and my stepdad gave me an electric guitar, and I was just thinking today about how it didn't even cross my mind that that was a possibility to own an electric guitar. You know, so just imagine this kid who loved rock music being given an electric guitar.
Right.
I slept with it. You know,
yeah.
It was just sort of like there was nothing better than that. And now I think about my kids. I have a room similar to this full of guitars and amps and drums and PA, and they can just play electric guitar whenever they want. I mean, I have to be there to supervise, but it's a little bit different for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then I put together a punk rock band. I mean, I say punk rock. We loved punk rock, and we had some punk leanings, but it was basically an 80s rock sort of new wave band called Verboten. That band played for a couple of years when I was a kid, ages 10 to 12, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really how I kind of learned how to be in a band and write songs and
right.
perform and the process, I guess.
Yeah. What is it like being in a band prepubescent? Like, you clearly can't get into the clubs that you're playing at. How do you even go about getting shows?
The weird thing is we did. We played at Cubby Bear in 83. So I was not quite 12. But yeah, it was mostly like schools and gymnasiums. I remember we played a battle of the bands up at New Trier High School. Or like parties, you know, friends' basements, you know.
Right.
Basically wherever we could play.
Yeah.
I don't know how we were allowed in that bar. Cubby Bear was just a dive at the time. Now it's kind of a sports, you know, it's like 50 TVs. But at the time, it was a dive. It was a black hole. Same location, just, you know, a tenth of the size.
Yeah.
And they had punk rock bands there. And our singer, Tracy, knew a lot of these bands. She would go to shows and befriend. I mean, she was friends with East Bay Ray from Dead Kennedys. And she knew Rights of the Accused and introduced us to them and Naked Reagan and all these bands that were happening at the time. So she would kind of get us the gigs.
Okay.
And she was a little older. She was 15 and 16. It's odd.
Yeah.
It's an odd story. I know. I'm looking at your face and it's...
Yeah. I mean, because I was interested in music at that age, but like writing songs was, you know, it was a ship in a bottle. I know it's in there, but I don't know how it got there.
Right.
And it's sort of similar to that, like getting a guitar. This is the tool of the trade. How does it work?
I know. I worked, I guess I just was so obsessed with it and was fortunate to have the encouragement of my bandmates, my friends, and my family, certainly. Although a lot of what was going on at home was what was fueling the energy to go create and do something.
Hello, I'm Chris Keene, bassist of Verboten. This next song is called Slum Shat, and it usually sounds like this.
He's looking for the key, for the act of you and me. He's trying to get to the slot. Too bad he's a slum shot. He's a little cat, tries a lot. Too bad he's a slum shot. Little cat, tries a lot. Too bad he's a slum shot.
You said it only lasted about 2 years.
Yeah.
I just sort of get this image of you as a 13, 14-year-old who's like, my best days are behind me.
We didn't think about it. I mean, I think we were proud that we had a band and that we played gigs, but, you know, the band broke up when I was 12. I hadn't even gone through puberty yet. There were so many things ahead of me.
Right.
And I became obsessed with basketball, and basketball players don't care about what you did with a guitar, or maybe they would for 5 minutes, and then the conversation changes.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until high school that I got back into it. And even then, I would play a little bit, but it wasn't as obsessive. And then when I got to college and it went back to being obsessive, that was like, okay, now I'm full on doing this.
Right.
Yeah.
I would imagine there would be a lot of like click. I'm guessing this is the Evanston school system.
Evanston Township High School. Yeah. Okay.
These are the jocks and they don't talk to the punks and the punks don't talk to the metal kids or
and I,
something
I had
like
friends
that.
In a lot of those realms. But I think for me, it was more that by sophomore year, you know, Evanston's such a massive high school that there was like, for boys basketball, there was two freshman teams, a sophomore team, a JV team, and a varsity team. And by my sophomore year, I was starting on the sophomore team. And I remember I had a breakaway. I was a point guard, and I had a breakaway, and I did a look-away pass. I had two guys on either side, and I looked at this guy, and I threw it to this guy, and he got a dunk. And that's a big moment sophomore year that, you know, somebody on the team got a dunk in a game. And I remember after the game, I was like, I saw you, Woody. You know, like, I got you covered. And he just dismissed it completely. And I remember that moment, I was like, I don't know if I have any friends on this team. Like, and that's okay. I love basketball, but it's just sort of like, this is a year-round job at a school like that.
For sure.
And I'm not really hanging with any of these guys. And so I stopped playing. And then junior year, I really enjoyed myself and got back into music a little bit more. And then by senior year, I missed it and tried out again and got cut because the guys had just completely surpassed, you know, I didn't play for a year and they did and they got better. And the guys that were younger than me were better than me. So it was just sort of like, okay, well, that part of my life is over.
Yeah. Before we sort of leave this time period, there's a video clip of you playing with the Cleaning Ladies wanted to mention because actually John Anderson is sort of a family friend.
Oh, awesome.
We dog sat for him while he was on tour with Brian Wilson.
You're
in
kidding.
Japan.
Was that out in St. Charles?
Yeah, when Brian was living in St. Charles.
He's really close with my dad. I haven't seen John, and honestly, I don't know. It's been years and years and years, but what a talented guy. It's funny you bring that up. No one asks about that, and I don't seem to bring it up, but that was quite an experience to be 10 years old and making a music video with these adult guys. That was before, or maybe during Verboten. It was probably Verboten had just started, but it's a pretty funny video.
Yeah. If you haven't seen this clip before, it's a proto-viral video that's well worth searching out. After an opening title card claims the footage represents the first documented example of child exploitation rock, we see the cleaning ladies playing a snotty garage rock rave-up about an intergenerational romantic rivalry in a wood-paneled suburban basement, while a snarling, prepubescent Jason credibly plays a gigantic-looking Gibson SG. Over the course of the song, lead singer John Anderson provokes Jason lyrically and physically, at one point attempting to suffocate him with a plastic bag, although Jason has the last laugh. Let's hear a little bit.
Social security, creeping humility, not what you used to be. You don't know all about now.
Yes, I wanna know how you found out. Give up, give up, give up, give up on my girl. I'd rather be a solid rock than a juvenile delinquent.
I'm proud of that video. I mean, it's that's 81. People weren't really making videos at home. I mean, they were film students at Northwestern, but have you heard of Steve Dahl, the DJ? He had a television show on WTTW on Channel 11. And, you know, in 1981 or 82 or whatever that was, there was only four or five television stations.
Yeah.
So when they played that video, it was a big deal. You know, like a lot of people saw it.
Yeah. I guess the next phase in your career is the Jason and Allison project. How did you first meet Allison, Chesley?
We worked together at a coffee shop in Evanston.
Okay.
And she was studying cello performance at Northwestern. I had a band, a trio called On. I was thinking about not doing that anymore and doing solo shows. And so I just asked her, I was like, how would you feel about playing? I think on the first few shows, she would just do like three or four songs with me. And then I was like, maybe, what do you think about playing on all the songs, you know?
Right.
And then there was one moment, I mean, we had only been playing together for 3 or 4 months, but somebody at Jam Productions, it might have been Nick Miller, had heard about us, and we got a call to open up for Ricky Lee Jones at the Vic.
Okay, that's a good show.
Huge venue for us, since we had never, you know, we played at Elbow Room, right up the block from here, and Beat Kitchen, and small clubs, but we'd never played, you know, 1,400-seat theater like that. Maybe not the best musical, not super compatible, but we weren't going to say no, you know. There was a lot of drama during soundcheck.
Okay.
I think Ricky maybe wasn't so healthy in those days. This is probably 93. And she had the stage manager ask us if we would perform almost off the stage, like way over in the corner, one light, one monitor, one mic stand. That's, you know, and we're like, yeah, sure. It's Ricky Lee Jones. We're not, you know, fine.
Just a guitar and a cello is pretty easy to
move around. I mean, we thought it was a little weird because it is so easy to just strike it and be out of her way. And she was performing solo. It wasn't a band. And then like 20 minutes later, we could hear all this. She was obviously upset about something. And then the stage manager called me into his office again. And he said, how would you feel about not performing with the cellist? And at the time, we were just billed as Jason Narduzzi with Allison Chesley. It wasn't Jason and Allison or Verbo or anything.
Right.
We weren't really a band yet. I don't know what it was, but something in me was like, no, I won't perform without the cellist. I didn't bring her here to have her sit and watch. Yeah. And he was relieved. He's like, oh, thank God you said that. You know, I'm so tired of dealing with this woman. Sure enough, 20 minutes before doors opened, she canceled the show.
Okay.
So she was serious. She called me on my bluff. And we never got asked to play with her again. But that's, you know, it's fine. But it's sort of, that was the moment where I was like, oh, I think Allison and I are going to perform together and have it be more of a band. And so then we really started to, we got a lot of breaks. We got offered to do a lot of cool shows. I was just thinking about, my phone went on shuffle and a Morphine song came on. And I remembered that we opened up for Morphine at First Avenue in Minneapolis as a duo, which I think was a better bill, you know, for us. And I loved Morphine. So that was cool for us. Yeah, so that's when that happened.
And writing songs for that project, was it any different writing to the dynamic range and frequency range of just two instruments, or there are three instruments with a voice?
Yeah. I was probably trying to figure it out. You know, I think I would bring songs to her, and then she would come up with parts, and I would have ideas for parts. And then sometimes songs are just like, oh, that doesn't really totally work, or maybe it's not a great song. But when we made that record, the Jason and Allison record, which is called Woodshed, I really went to battle with the engineer in the studio because I was hearing this wall of sound thing, and I think he was looking at us going, oh, well, it's a folk duo.
Yeah.
And so I wanted it produced like My Bloody Valentine, where it's just compressed and vocals buried, which he didn't like at all. So there was some long discussions during the mixing of that record, but I'm real proud of it. I'm real happy with the way it turned out.
From Jason and Allison's only album as a duo, 1995's Woodshed, here's a track fittingly titled Loveless Park.
Holding my bottomless cup of you, sipping as the trees go by, for I'm uprooted too.
I still play two of those songs when I do solo shows.
Excellent.
I've been doing a lot of living room shows lately, a lot of like small club / living room shows, and I play two of those songs almost every time.
And I can also start to hear the Bob Mould influence on that.
Massive, yeah.
I mean, even the name of the album, Woodshed, is sort of a synonym for workbook.
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
Were you like going to Bob's shows?
And yeah, in fact, one of our breaks that we got, again, it came back to Nick Miller at Jam. I'm not sure if he did the Ricky Lou thing, but he definitely had heard of me because I was performing Workbook in its entirety as a solo act. I did that twice, or maybe three times. I know I did it at Elbow Room and Beat Kitchen. I might have done it at this room called Morrisland too. But he saw that, and I think he was in touch with Bob because he would promote a lot of Bob Mould shows. And there's this guy that's playing Workbook all the way through. And so he suggested to Bob that Allison and I open up these three sold-out Metro shows that Bob was playing. And because I had gone to so many shows and even gone to like sound checks and met him, Bob's like, you know, describe Jason and Allison to me. And Nick is describing it. And he goes, I know who Jason is. But then, you know, we did those three shows and Bob took us on tour after that and offered to produce the next record, which of course we were thrilled to do that. It happened very quickly.
What was the process of sort of morphing from Jason and Allison into Verbo and adding a rhythm section and making it more of a rock band?
Well, I wrote, I guess you would call them Jason and Allison songs first, and some of those made the record. Distance Between Us, Execution of a Jester, there was a song called Candy Car that got cut, there was a song called Forgiving Glass that got cut, Slumbering Blue. I mean, half of the record was just the two of us. Mm-hmm. And then I started writing rock songs, because honestly, part of me was like, Bob Mould wants to produce a record by me. I let's get the guitars out. You know?
Yeah.
So I started writing very Cheap Trick style songs because there was such a huge influence on me. And I knew that Bob got where that was. That was a connection that Bob and I had, was Cheap Trick and The Who. And little did I realize, I didn't realize until years later, but if you're going to write Cheap Trick style songs and have Bob Mould produce it, it's going to sound like Sugar. Which a lot of moments on that record really do. But
yeah.
Allison obviously adds a whole other different kind of color to that, her solos and such. But I see that happened in, I was 25 years old or something. I mean, I was just as thrilled as you would imagine working with your hero, you know, spending 8 days in Austin, Texas making a record. It's pretty great.
Here's a track released as a single from Verbo's debut album, 1997's Chronicles, called Holiday.
Talked to a bunch of musicians who were on major labels or talking to major labels in this mid-90s time when they were just throwing money at things.
Yeah.
They had like a really good ride and then were left on the side of the road, sort of. But
I mean, I guess I've never felt that way. I feel very fortunate that we got the attention of major labels when people were buying records.
Right.
And when Kurt Cobain changed the climate, and I was produced by Bob Mould, who influenced Kurt Cobain. So there's this... You could say that that's when trickle-down really did work.
Mm-hmm.
Trickle-down economics and rock benefited me to a great extent. But I was never good at, like, I don't think about the trends very much, because in 94 I released this acoustic record with a cello,
yeah.
And then in 97 I released a rock record, which it was already done, you know, that phase of rock music. But we were very fortunate to get the attention. And it wasn't like stupid money, but it was a lot of money.
Right.
And
this was Epic Records?
Yeah. I mean, it was a subsidiary. It's called 550 Music, but it was through Epic. I mean, we worked with Epic people. And it's a shame it didn't sell well just because our deal was so good.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been very
fruitful.
But I mean, look, we did these two records with Epic. We toured with Morrissey. We toured with Frank Black. Played with bands like Morphine and all these bands that I looked up to.
Yeah.
It was awesome. It was great.
Yeah.
I learned so much and made connections with people that I adore and still have so many friendships from that time. And I look back on it fondly. Of course, there was disappointments. I wish that somebody had told... You knew that the business was scummy and that there were people you had to avoid. And
right.
I felt like I had a pretty good radar for that. And I never felt like I got totally burned by anybody. There was a couple people that tried to pull some stuff. And But I wish that somebody had said to me, in this business, and maybe this is the same for any kind of entertainment, you know, maybe for actors and writers, you basically get told no 800 times for every yes.
Right.
And I just wasn't prepared for that. You know, I was just getting shot down, and then you get a nice break. And that's just how it is, you know, forever or a long time. And then, you know, if you become successful enough that you can make some decisions, maybe the ratios change a little bit. But that would have been helpful for my psyche, I think, if someone had warned me of that. And now I'm used to it, and it still happens, and that's fine, you know.
Let's talk a bit about the second Verbo album, White Out. This was produced by Brad Wood.
Yep.
And it's definitely got that very, very bright and shiny sound to it. I think Scott Miller in his book mentioned one of the Verbo songs as being like a loudness war mastering job. And like,
which book is this?
It's Scott Miller, the guy from Game Theory and Loud Family.
Oh, okay. He mentioned a Verbo?
Yeah, I think New History.
Like, oh.
It's a really cool book. It sort of like makes him the patron saint of music nerddom. It's like 20, 25 songs for each year.
Interesting.
Music history.
Oh, okay.
New History is there right after Everything in Its Right Place.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
But yeah, he did say it's this Brad Wood, Chris Lord-Alge,
yes,
in your face thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, what was the experience in the studio like of sort of making something very loud and radio friendly at that time?
Well, we didn't make it in a studio. We rented a house in Michigan, actually owned by Joe Shanahan, who owns Metro. And I didn't know Joe that well at the time. It was basically through Brad. Brad knew him better. He just had this small little house in Michigan for his family, and we asked if we could rent it for a month right when a snowstorm hit. I mean, the first day was shoveling 3 feet of snow or something. That's why the record's called White Out.
Okay.
Then we mixed it in Chicago at Gravity Studios, and that song, New History, man, there's just so much about that. First of all, that was the first time I recorded on Pro Tools.
Okay.
And it was a huge help on that song because we got to the mixing standpoint. I had written this really strange bridge. I think part of it is still in the song, this like talking part. And then it was such a mess, that song, but it was catchy. And, you know, our A&R guy at the time was like, oh, we like this one, you know. We get in the mix and I'm like, God, what if it just breaks down and it's just acoustic guitar and me singing the chorus, and then the band comes back in. Mm. In Pro Tools, you can do that.
Yeah.
You know, if it was on tape, too late.
Good luck. Yeah.
Too late. Try next time. You know, so that was kind of a moment where I was like, oh, people are angry at the computers because it can be used as a crutch for some people, but what about this element of it? Like the cut and paste, which I think greatly improved that song and made it a stronger... Just got the story moving quicker. We chopped that bridge in it by two-thirds or something and then added that thing.
From Verbo's second and final album, 2000's White Out, this is New History.
Days tied me over until it comes down like a boulder and knocks me around and I feel older wet. I skip. Thank you.
for sure there was something in me, and it's this competitive thing where I made the first Verbo record, Chronicles, or we made it, and it just didn't get very much attention radio-wise or press-wise, although WXRT did play Holiday. They added the song, which was incredible for us. And this time I was like, well, you know that like it's a two-record deal, so this is it. You know, like, and the competitor in me was like, oh, well, I'm just going to put five hit songs on this and see, you can't do anything with this. You know, I thought for sure Sweet Felicity was like an undeniable radio song and brings out the strings. You know? I mean, Allison's cello playing in that song is just ridiculous. And I liked that it was dark and haunting. It wasn't just like a sellout radio song. It was about being lonely, you know? But we tried mixing New History over and over and over again. And I think by the end of the second day of mixing that song, which I've never done anything like that, spent even a day on one song mixing it. This was at the end of the second day. I had to leave the control room just to keep my ears fresh because I was totally burnt out on the song and on the mixing. And Brad Wood came into the room. He's like, okay, I think we're ready for you to listen again. And it was like 11 at night. We'd been there another 12-hour day. And he plays it for me, and I just looked at him, and I go, I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
So it was exhausting. And I feel like I'm pretty decisive about those things. It just worn me down.
Yeah, that's sort of Chinese water torture to listen to the same song for 2 days straight.
Yeah. I can get into that mode, you know, that detail work mode, and Bob Mould is intense with that. I mean, when we make records now, I mean, he's going through every single note and how it lines up with the bass drum, and I'm happy to do that. I mean, on the last three records that I've made with him, there's usually a day of us going through every single song and tightening up those notes that it comes by. And it's like, that doesn't totally lock up.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love rolling up the sleeves and doing that. But at that moment with that song, I was fried. We finished the record and then we went out on tour. And I remember looking at the album, trying to write a set list and just going, I don't want to play half of these songs. It was a tough time.
I don't know very much about the next project, Rockets Over Sweden.
Yeah.
I've just like seen the name a couple of places and there's a couple of YouTube clips, but like you put out an EP, like what was sort of the change between Verbo and that project?
I don't know. I was trying to just kind of reinvent myself and I thought it'd be cool to have my friend Eddie play distorted bass keyboards instead of bass, just to give it a different sonic thing. And then the drummer who played it on the Verbo records, David Sycott's an amazing drummer. We just thought, well, what if we played on tiny instruments and kind of in-your-face garage rock? We just never caught on, you know? We played a lot. I started doing shows. We would play like Monday night and Tuesday night and not tell anybody just because I wanted to play a bunch of shows to get better before I did tell people.
Right.
I think we got to be okay, but it lost momentum pretty quickly. And then there's this band called Tributosaurus in Chicago. And they asked me to play the first Tributosaurus at Martyrs, which must have been 03 or something, 02, 03, which was The Who. I never met those guys, but they knew I was a Who fan. And I met other musicians there, like this guy named Chris Siebold. And we started a cover band called Sellout. So I did that for like 2003, 2004. And then in 2005, Bob Mould asked me to join his band as bassist. And that's when I was like, oh, I think I'm a band member. I think I can play bass with other bands. And I got really, really fortunate, you know, with Bob Pollard. And which show did you see with Bob Pollard?
Metro.
Yeah.
I remember I was too young to see the last Guided by Voices show.
Right, which was just a couple of years before. Yeah.
And so I think that show was an 18 or older show. So I was able to get there and I'm 18 and like psyched to be at this show without parental supervision.
Yeah.
And then Bob like tosses a bottle of Cuervo into the front row and I'm like, all right, well,
here we go.
Yeah. This is a rock and roll show now.
Yeah. Yeah.
From Moon, a live album capturing Robert Pollard and the Ascended Masters opening an arena show for Pearl Jam. Here's a track featuring Jason on bass and backing vocals called Dancing Girls and Dancing Men.
Dancing girls, I'll take you home, up in my chest. Dancing in, it's what you do your best. And if you call me back tomorrow night, you'll call and I'll be gone. Cause you know that I don't dance, and the night keeps us all down. You selected, and your bride will be known. When she finds you, I'll be thrown in your house. In your house.
Russian Express. For parents in the holy will not be in training. For we wish for position, how we pitch in condition to get hitched. Be selected and your pride will be known. If you find it, I'll be grown. In your highway, in your highway. This is the chorus.
Quite a tour. Unfortunately, Tommy Keane just passed away,
yeah.
Which is really sad. He was such a blast. And that's where I met John Worster, too.
And the two of you are just sort of like indie rock's rhythm section now.
We've been so fortunate to play with all these great... I got him in the Bob Mould Band. I think he had a lot to do with me joining Superchunk. Mm. And it's such a joy playing and traveling with him.
Yeah, it seems like you'd have to be like really tight friends in order to like not just be in one band, but to be in two or three.
Right. Yeah, I think, well, 2013 was a little bit crazy because both bands were during an album cycle. But this year is almost all Superchunk.
Okay.
So that makes it a little easier to not kind of walk on stage and go, which?
Which band? Which set list?
And I think it helps John and I that we lead such completely different lives. Mm. You know, I've got small businesses that I run in Chicago, and I've got kids, and I'm married, and he's got his comedy things, and he's in the Mountain Goats. So, like, we have all these other things.
Right.
And we're not completely tied together. I mean, he's got way more people know him from comedy than playing with me in some bands, you know. Right. But, yeah, I've been, again, really fortunate to run into him and get to do so many projects with him.
Going from being a huge Bob Mould fan to being the guy on stage doing the backing vocals, what was the process of like learning the back catalog?
I took an approach that I learned through basketball, actually. Mm. The worlds collided on this one. When I was a kid, I went to Doug Collins' basketball camp when he was the coach of the Chicago Bulls, and Michael Jordan came and talked to the campers. And he said, never walk into a gymnasium and just toss up a shot and jog over and get it and walk over and toss up a shot. He's like, you're practicing the wrong thing. You never do that in a game. He said, I see kids stand at the free throw line and shoot 30 free throws in a row. You never do that in a game. Shoot two free throws, run a lap around the gym, shoot two more free throws. And it just sort of like really clicked with me about, yeah, practice what you're going to do.
Yeah.
My wife was nice enough to let me set up basically a sound stage in our garage where I had three bass amps, super loud, and then a mic and a mic stand going through a PA, and the PA is facing me with the Husker Du and Bob Mould and Sugar catalog. Full volume. I practice all summer. I guess I owe big thanks to the city of Evanston and my neighbors. That really helped me get ready. Now, saying that, one thing I was not prepared for, and even in rehearsals it didn't really happen, but once we got to the first show, which happened to be in Ireland, it's jet lagged as hell. There was no sound check because it was a festival. It's just, they call it a throw and go, where you just throw the gear up there and go.
Yep.
Bob is just such an intense performer, and he doesn't really sing the songs the same way.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And so when you're singing backup vocals, I'm jet lagged. I can't hear anything because it's so loud and massive, you know? I was holding on for dear life on those early shows, but you talk about the backing vocal. Certainly, I'm thinking about, like, well, the great David Barbie sang backup on this live, or Grant Hart sang backup. You know, like,
right.
You're thinking about the legacy and these great bands that I'm trying to uphold, you know, the integrity of for a moment. They don't need me to, but you know what I mean? You want the crowd to feel like, well, this is good. And then Bob's just singing something else. I'm just like, whoa, where am I? But it's been, I mean, that was 13 years ago, and I feel like I can hear where he's going now.
Okay.
You know, if he's starting to lose his voice a little bit, he goes higher and I go lower. Mm-hmm. You know? And there's still moments, especially if he's been doing solo shows and then he joins the band, he sings the songs differently because he's just doing the little adjustments like that that you just kind of learn as the years go on. You just get thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
Here's the Bob Mould Band, recorded by Chicago station WXRT at an afternoon session at Reggie's Rock Club in June 2014, before a small audience, which I was lucky enough to be a part of, blasting through an awesome take of If I Can't Change Her Mind.
You've had your fill. If I can't change your mind, then no one will. If I can't change your mind, oh. Oh. And all throughout the years, never strayed from you, my dear. No disrespect, I'm somewhere else. Feeling sorry for your soul, leaving with a broken heart. Love you even still. If I can't change your mind, then no one will. If I can't change your mind now, oh, even though my heart is breaking, don't you know that I'll be waiting here for you. Then when you when the year returns, hope you see I'm dedicated. Look how long that I have waited. You come back, you will find different passions if you change your mind. Can't change your mind and no one will. I know, I know, I know. If I can't change your mind now, I know, I know you said, oh yeah, someday you'll see I've been true. Stay that way until. If I can't change your mind and no one will. I know, I know. If I can't change your mind. Change your mind, no, no. If I can't change your mind now, I know, I know. If I can't change your mind.
Some of the other bands that you've played with live, Superchunk and Telekinesis, is that more of a case of they'll just give you the new album and say, learn these up?
Yeah, because Superchunk, Laura's still in the band, so mm-hmm. I guess my title would be touring bassist.
Okay.
And there's, again, they're so generous with that. Like, they've put me in some of the videos, and one time we did Fallon, and Laura came back for that, but they had me play guitar, which I thought was so cool of them. Yeah. They didn't have to do that. So, yeah, in those cases, they send me the record. It's funny, we're about to leave for tour, and I got a hold of Mac, and I was like, is it possible to send me the record? I would like to look at the lyrics so I can work on background vocals. And some people probably would just assume that I have the record, and I don't. That's kind of funny to me. Yeah, so I'm learning by ear. And really, I've been able to do that for a long time, but the Pollard touring made me much better at it because, you know, he has 55 songs a show, mm-hmm. and he would bring in new songs as the touring would go on. So just constantly learning songs. And Superchunk does that too, because Mac really wants to have a very different set list every night. So it's not uncommon for me to be learning songs at soundcheck with Superchunk, and I like that too. I like that urgency that comes with, totally know this one, but yeah. here we go, you know? And it's not uncommon, you know, people who have seen a lot of Superchunk shows over the last 5 years, I'll gesture to Jim across the stage, like, face me, please. You know, like, let me look at that left hand so I have a better idea of where I'm going here. And John Worster is great at kind of conducting when he can see that I'm, you know, we're heading into this song that we've never played. And, you know, he'll kind of go like, and here comes the, you know? They're very supportive in that way.
When did you start Split Single?
In December of 2011, my friend Steve Dawson, who's a Chicago singer-songwriter, he's got a band, Dolly Varden.
Yeah, Dolly Varden's great.
Incredible band. He said, we're playing at Shuba's next month. We don't have an opener. Would you like to open? And I was like, sure, what do you want me to do? And he's like, whatever you want. I was like, okay. I hadn't been asked to perform in so long. It's just something in me was like, you know what? I don't want to play any Verbo songs. I don't want to play any songs from my past. So I challenged myself to write 10 brand new songs.
Okay.
And asked my friend Jay Ryan, who's a poster maker, to play bass. And my friend Jason Bachko, who's a great drummer, play drums. And I was like, how do you guys feel about learning 10 songs that I just wrote really quickly? They were game. And I just kind of told myself, like, this could fall flat and be terrible. But I would rather do that than go backwards with the songs. It just wasn't. My head was not in those songs in the past.
Right, that was like 10 years earlier.
Yeah, at that point it was, well, yeah, because Whiteout came out in 2000, so it's 12 years later.
Yeah.
The show went well, and I was excited about at least three of the songs and just kept on writing. And then we were recording Silver Age in San Francisco, and I told John about it and played him Never Look Back. And I was like, oh, what do you think of this? He's like, it's great. I was like, how do you feel about recording them with me? He's like, sure. So that's when that whole thing started. I started making more demos and asked Britt Daniel, and he said yes.
From 2014's Fragmented World, this is Split Single with Never Look Back.
Fun project for me. I love, I'm excited about writing songs, and I like making the videos to get the word out. It's fun to kind of be creative in that way. Try a little comedy, and there's, you know, there's also just straight ahead videos too, but
yeah,
I like the fact that I'm just releasing records out of my basement. It's kind of this fun
Yeah.
There's no management, no booking agent, no team. It's just basically me and a publicist swinging.
Yeah.
taking big swings.
and having had that experience with the major label machinery behind you in the 90s, do you think it's better to like just do everything yourself and have total control over publicity and distribution?
I'm enjoying it now, but I don't think I had, you know, when I was 25 and 26, I don't think I had the gumption. Like, it was already too consuming for me just to write songs and perform them and keep a band together. It wasn't until the split single thing came up where I realized, and I sent the music out to labels I liked and no one wanted to put it out. And I was like, well, I guess this is all on me. How am I going to reach an audience? And that's when I started to think of, you know, like Sexiest Elbows and rock music. Yeah. And so I was sort of forced into that corner. In some ways, I was able to come out a little bit more that way because it was in me to do that stuff. But I guess I did have this mentality that, well, I make the music and I hand it over to a label and they, okay, you guys do something. You know? When really my strength maybe, or at least I'm enjoying it more to kind of go like, well, how do I want to present this? You know, like on the last record of Metal Frames, the Untry Love video was just an incredibly fun experience for me, not only to work with Dave Hill and Anya Marina, but to kind of write this comedy thing that ties the story together. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I think that it brings a different audience, but not an audience that's unfriendly to it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the indie rock people and the comedy people follow each other on Twitter.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot of crossover.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Split Single is a live band. It is different from the Split Single on record.
Yep.
I saw you at Shuba's last year, and I recognized the rhythm guitar player was the guy from the Redwalls.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, I know that guy from somewhere.
Yeah.
What was the process of putting together a live band?
I mean, it's pretty similar to recording. It's just sort of like, are you interested? Are you available?
Mm-hmm.
With the live thing, you know, like that show that you saw at Shuba's, that must have been, was it last April when we were on tour with Kelly Deal?
Yeah, yeah.
So the trio was touring, but for the home show, I got that, you know, was able to ask Andrew to join us.
Okay.
It's just sort of like, yeah, what, who's available? I'm fortunate to know so many talented musicians in Chicago that, I mean, there's just so many. I think Tim Remus, the guy who often plays drums, but not always in the band, he and I were trying to think of how many bassists we've played with, and it's something like 12 or something. It's absurd, you know. And it's not a bad thing. It's just sort of like people move on or they're too busy with this or, you know what I mean? Like I feel like I've learned from them all, and that's a cool musical thing to work with people and go, oh, they're doing that. That's kind of cool. Or they're using this pedal or they're, you know, you can, you learn so much from talented musicians and see, you know, observe their approach. And it's a really fun project for me to do it that way.
So yeah, you've mentioned this new Superchunk album is coming out this year and you're going to be touring around that.
What a Time to Be Alive, it's called. And it's a great record. We have tons of US dates, Europe dates. It's very, very busy 2018 with Superchunk.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Are there any plans for any of the other projects?
Nothing. I mean, whispers here and there, but nothing official. Okay. I've been writing, but I don't have any plans for Split Single right now.
Okay.
I've been working on a musical, a local.
Really?
Yeah. I can't talk about the project entirely yet because some things are still waiting to see if they come through, but I've written 18 songs for that. That's been a really cool challenge.
Nice.
Yeah. Very different, but really, really good, talented people working on that. So yeah, a lot of solo shows where I intertwine older songs and Split Single songs and a couple covers every once in a while. But I did that last November and it just went so well that that's why I'm doing three more this year.
Nice.
Maybe more. Let's see, in March 6th through 10th, it's Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Columbus, Ann Arbor, and Toronto. And then in July, there'll be more Midwest dates. And I think later in the year, some East Coast dates. So busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's just about all the time we have for this week. Thanks again to Jason Narducci for taking the time to talk with Stereo Hysteria, and to John Anderson for providing the remastered Cleaning Ladies track. Catch Jason on tour this year with Split Single and Superchunk. Follow him on Twitter at Split Single Band, and find more information, including tour dates, at splitsinglemusic.com. Be sure to tune in again next week when our topic will be songs about invisibility. But before we go, I'll leave you with a highlight from Split Single's most recent album, 2016's Metal Frames, featuring bass guitar by Wilco's John Sturrott and harmony vocals by Nora O'Connor, called Leave My Mind. This is Charlie, signing off.